This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Anorexia, self-starvation, and bulimia, gorging and purging, are eating disorders associated with women and girls. They can be dangerous and sometimes fatal. Most specialists believe that males made up only about 10% of eating disorder cases, but a study by researchers at Harvard reports that percentage is up to 25%, and if binge eating is included, 40%. Females typically develop eating disorders from an obsession with thinness. In men, the Harvard study says, it's the pursuit of ripped stomach muscles, the so-called six-pack abs, and males face some problems women don't have. They're often reluctant to get help, especially for a condition associated with women, and doctors may overlook the problem. Later in the program, Europe's tiny smart car hits the United States. It's cute, easy to park, and fuel efficient. Would you buy one? First, eating disorders and men. If you face the problem yourself or if you know someone who does, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Our first guest is Ron Saxon, a model who graced the covers of magazines 20 years ago. His eating disorder destroyed his modeling career and threatened his health and his sanity. He's written a book about it called The Good Eater, and he joins us now from the studio at the University of California, Berkeley's School of Journalism, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil, for having me on.
And when did you realize you had an eating disorder?
Well, my disordered eating acts was very young at the age of 11, but when I knew that something was desperately wrong was in 1982 at the age of 19. At that time, there was no formal classification for binge eating disorder, so I didn't know what it was. I knew it was a flaw. It was something I was embarrassed with, ashamed of, and I felt that it was just something I needed to buck up, get strong, get over, and stop doing it.
And that's not easy to do on your own, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, I wouldn't say it's impossible to do on your own, but the problem that most people face, men especially, is we want to solve our own problems. And kind of one of the messages in my book is don't put off starting your journey to recovery, no matter what it is, anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, alcoholism, whatever. Just begin your journey and step forward. I wasted probably 15 to 20 good years of my life that I'll never get back with feeling in mental and physical chaos. And there's, you know, you can try to do it on your own. I told myself every single day before I go to bed that I would never do that again. Starting tomorrow, I'll be perfect. And of course, I never was. So, you know, help. You know, there's plenty of books. There's organizations like NIDA. Look out for the resources and go forward.
How did you control your weight if you were a binge eater and a model? Presumably, you need to be very trim.
Yeah, that's the impossible thing. That's what made the story so compelling. You know, you can be anorexic and be too thin or bulimic and eat too much and vomit, but when you binge 10,000 calories and don't purge, you'll have a problem. And so I was, you know, my weight would go up and then it would come down because I would arrest the behavior using something called willpower, which is worthless. Until you figure out what the eating disorder function is in your life and arrest it and replace it and put the eating disorder out of business, you're always going to go back because willpower isn't solving anything. And so I would go up and down in weight. And one time I got really low. Right before I typically would go up, I got a little extra low. And people came to me and said, so are you a male model? And I was like, are you kidding me? I haven't had a date in 2 years. I don't think I'm a model. And at that time, I was a 21-year-old virgin and wasn't proud of it. So I went down to the bookstore and I checked a book out on male models and saw that I was about 20 pounds overweight. And so I did some horrible things that are very unhealthy to get that last 20 pounds off. And next thing you know, I was signing a one-year modeling contract. And the deal was, it wasn't if I was going to blow a head gasket, it was when I was going to blow a head gasket. And I thought by being a male model that my life would be perfection, that these beautiful people, how can you be any happier? You can get the girl, you can get rid of that virginity thing you're ashamed of. And that the magic, which is the title of my first chapter, would be so powerful that it would push my crazy insanity that I did not understand, because back in 82, there was no formal classification for BED. That didn't come until 1992. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was wrong. I mean, I would do a fashion show, and about 4 days later, I'd do a binge, and I'd go run 10 miles, 15 miles, get it off. Then the next time, I'd be on TV, and then the binge would be 2 days later, until one time I had a photo session with an awesome photographer, very famous. And I was lucky to be in front of her lens, And 3 hours later, I was eating 3,000 calories. And then one day it all ended when I had a fashion show. The guy said, I like your look. I need you to lose 5 pounds because there's an underwear set and you got to look good. And at that point, I pulled the pin on my career, went off and gained 70 pounds in 6 months and was never heard from again.
In an odd way, it sounds like what you're describing is an addiction.
Yeah, well, what it is this. It's an addiction. Yeah, it can be addiction. What happens is all eating disorders serve what's called an adaptive function. They have a function in your life. And my function was that my eating disorder was how I managed stress and anxiety. I had a very chaotic childhood. It was tough on me and my brothers and sisters. We had a fundamentalist religion that preached to us the world could end at any moment, plus the other stuff. And I didn't want to feel. And I discovered through an accidental 3 pounds of chocolate that it could take away the feeling and I could feel nothing. And so as you get older and you go on and you learn that the way to get rid of anxiety and to block it out is to numb yourself with food, of course, when you do that 11, 12, 15, 20, 30, you know, it stunts your growth and bad things happen. And so instead of facing a problem like normal people do and say, what do? I go left? Do I go right? Do I confront the issue, the person, the job, whatever? You escape in food. And you do that enough, and then one day you end up where I was with a full-blown binge eating disorder.
And you're also hiding it from people. This is embarrassing.
Oh, exactly. And that's the one disorder. Binge eating disorder is the easiest to hide. I only got busted. 20 years of partying like a rock star. I got popped one time. And what it taught me, the moment I got caught by my college roommate eating all the cake and the box of honeycombs, was that, one, I was hoping that he would scare the hell out of me and I'd somehow that would make me stop. Of course, it didn't. But it made me say, well, I'll never do that again. You know, in anorexia, you can't hide. You look like hell. You look like Auschwitz pretty soon. Or you die. You can't hide that. If you have bulimia, you suddenly get these kind of jowls because the glands pop. And then it's strange how you always go to the bathroom after a meal.
Mm-hmm. And binge eating disorder,
you hide.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, so binge eating disorder, you just go off in your car like I did and you do your thing. No one knows. And everybody gains weight. Men are, you know, we all get overweight. And so when you gain a bunch of weight, you're just obese like a lot of people are. They don't have an eating disorder. So it's easy to hide. It's the most hidden disorder of all.
Let's see if we get some listeners in on the conversation. We're talking with Ron Saxon, a former male model who's written about his eating disorder in a book called The Good Eater. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And a reminder of our blog, blog of the nation at npr.org/blog of the nation, all one word. And let's get Jim on the line. Jim's with us from Kent, Ohio.
Hi.
Hello.
Jim.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm glad to be on the show.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I have experienced a lot of what you've been talking about. I'm now 40 years old, but probably since about the time I was 18 is when I started lifting weights. And I started binge eating to try to gain weight. And I thought that if I could have this perfect look and this perfect body, that women would be attracted to me. I also grew up without a mother, so I think that drove me even further to try and get women in my life. Mm-hmm. And I still experience that today. I'm 40 years old. I'm married. I have 2 children. But I still go through bouts where I will eat and binge eat, and then I will go to the gym and I'll try and lose weight, and then I'll change my eating immediately, and it drives my wife crazy, and I still experience that today. And I was talking to the producer earlier, and I said that I also experience body dysmorphia, where I used to think I was really skinny, and now, you know, and I look at pictures of me when I was lifting weights, and I'm like, I was pretty big, but I always had this image in my mind that I was a smaller person than what I really was.
Yeah, and have you gotten help, I wonder, Jim?
No, I never. I've been through counseling through other issues in my life, as far as having a mother who is an alcoholic. But as far as specific issues on eating and things like that, I never actually went to a counselor. I'm still kind of, I think, embarrassed and ashamed about that.
But now you have gone to a counselor for other things, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great, because you tell you what, men don't go to the counselor for anything. So if you've done the deed and you've gone to a counselor for something, that says a lot about you, because that's something I didn't want to do. There's no way I want to cross that threshold into craziness, because, you know, you're not crazy. But I would say if you've had the guts to embrace this other issue that you've had to seek help, there's There's organizations called like the National Eating Disorder Association. They can put you in contact. Just Google. There's lots of things you can do. But if you've been brave enough to seek help for other things, you should seek help for this. And it's not uncommon. Go ahead.
I didn't even realize that. I didn't think about the severity of what I was doing until I met my wife and she pointed out these unusual eating patterns and the binge eating and then switching to eating very healthy and going back and forth. And I just thought that was, you know, I wanted to make my body better, so I would just go to the extreme and just eat really well,
sure,
and work out really hard. And
sure,
and then all of a sudden, mm-hmm, I go to the other way and just totally be out of control and eating fast food and gaining weight and everything. And I still struggle with that today.
Yeah, there's a lot there. One of the things that you touched on was something called cognitive distortion. That's basically not perceiving things accurately. You see yourself as, I'm too skinny back then, and the truth of the matter, you wasn't. But I'm sorry, I lost track of what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. That was a good point.
Just about the binge eating and going back.
Okay. Here. Thank you very much for keeping me on track. The deal is that, you know, the DSM-4, which is a psychological thing, it says to be classified as BED, you got to do it twice a week for 6 months. Of course, that's where I was at one point in my life. And the goal is not to get there. You don't wait till you're there and then try to deal with it, because then it really sucks, because it's a lot to come back from. But if you've got things that you're doing now, they're disordered eating acts. Like when I was 11, I had disordered eating acts, but I did not have BED. So if you can stop this along the way, that's a good thing. Now, there's one other thing. There's a book out there called Intuiting. I bet you eat healthy, but you also eat things that you don't like mentally and physically. So when you deprive yourself, when you're being this healthy thing that you're doing, then suddenly you're not getting satiation in your body and your mind. And then suddenly you get sick of that, and then you go off on a bad eating situation instead of a healthy eating situation. So I recommend that book. It talks about balance. It's good to eat really healthy things that aren't actually mentally satisfying, but it's also good to eat things that are kind of fun that are mentally satisfying. So I think that would be very helpful for you.
Jim, good luck to you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for your time.
And Ron Saxon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Ron Saxon is the author of The Good Eater. He joins us today from Berkeley, California. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about eating disorders long associated with women and girls. Now a new study shows that more men suffer from anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating than previously thought. And joining us now is Dr. Terrell Bravender, Director of Adolescent Medicine at the Duke University Medical Center, who treats people with eating disorders. And Dr. Bravender, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
And we'd like to welcome those of you listeners who face this problem or know someone who has to give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And Dr. Bravender, we just heard Ron Saxon talking earlier and some of the callers with him. Men are very reluctant to get help.
Well, you know, if you look at all medical visits for any reason at all, in adolescents and young adults, about 65-70% of all those visits are by women. So very, very few men go to the doctor for anything at all. And I think when it comes to a mental health issue, men are even more reluctant to come in and get help. I mean, if the old stereotype is right about men never wanting to stop and ask for directions, how simple is that compared to actually saying that you're struggling with something like an eating disorder?
Mm-hmm. And the reluctance also is because it's a condition associated with women.
Well, exactly. And I think that women who come in for treatment for an eating disorder elicit a whole team approach. And the first thing that people will think of, I think, if a woman comes in with symptoms of anorexia is anorexia. Back when I was a resident in training about 15 years ago, I was taught that any adolescent boy or young man coming in with symptoms of anorexia should have a much, much more extensive evaluation, including a head MRI and complete scans to rule out any other illness, because anorexia was, I was taught, was so incredibly rare in men that it almost never happened. I think we know that's not not the case anymore. But still, getting people to come in to get treatment is the next challenge.
Here's an email we have from one of our listeners named Tony. My 15-year-old son has been in the hospital for the past 2 weeks with an eating disorder. We're not sure how long he will be hospitalized. His problems are very complex. He's truly suffering with gender identity, among many other issues. Since this is considered a female disorder, he's the only boy on a girl's ward and is having a tough time opening up in therapy sessions. I'm wondering, with a kid that's suffering from a gender issue, is it healthy for him to be with a group of girls in therapy? Does this make it more difficult for his recovery? Any insight you might provide would be helpful.
That's a tough issue, and that's one that we struggle with down here. And I've had a number of my male patients say that they feel very unusual coming into our eating disorders program because a waiting room is always filled with girls and young women. I think that number one issue for this boy is to get the treatment he needs. And I think that bringing those issues out into the open about how uncomfortable he feels being around the girls is the best you can do right now. I think that if he needs inpatient care, that it's called milieu therapy, meaning how he interacts with the other patients is important. But again, I think that needs to be brought up with the group. Unfortunately, I think the family is going to be hard-pressed to find any inpatient treatment center that isn't primarily focused on girls and young women, because that's who come in for treatment the most.
Let's get some listeners in the conversation. This is Carolyn. Carolyn with us from East Lansing in Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay. I was wondering if you could talk about what some of the symptoms might be, or how to talk about, if you suspect someone has an eating disorder, how would you know about it, and how could you talk to them about it?
Sure, this is a question that we get very frequently, and like the author previously to this said, certainly binge eating disorder can remain hidden for years and years, and similarly with bulimia. And I think that for people concerned, either about a friend or certainly parents who are concerned, I think it's important to bring this up with the young person in a very caring manner, so in a non-accusatory way. And one of the suggestions that I often use is to use what are called I statements. So rather than saying, "I think you're doing this," you say, "I'm worried, and here's why." So I'm worried because it seems like you're much more isolated than you used to be, or I'm worried about your weight loss, or I'm worried because I can't find the food that's disappearing, and couch it in terms that indicate you want to help that person, or find a professional who can offer help rather than accusing them of doing something wrong. Because anything that's accusing is just going to exacerbate the kind of feelings of shame that go along with many of these eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Carolyn, good luck.
Thank you.
One should not underestimate the ability of people to hide these disorders, too.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that when you mentioned the disorders can appear almost like an addiction, I think that's a model that we use quite frequently. And binge eating disorder certainly is hidden, and bulimia is too. And I think one of the misconceptions about bulimia I would like to bring up is that patients don't have to vomit after they eat in order to have bulimia, and they can use any kind of maladaptive compensatory behavior to make up for that binge. So I had one patient who would have huge binges and then fast for 2 or 3 days after the binge and compulsively exercise. And she fit the diagnostic criteria for bulimia. Now, she never binged. She didn't look abnormal. She was a normal weight. But that type of behavior fit criteria for bulimia. And she had been going about it for about 2 or 3 years before finally her roommate noticed her behavior when she was in college and called her parents, who finally brought her in for treatment.
Mm-hmm. It's also, well, let's see if we get some more callers on the line. And this is, we'll go to Rick. Rick's with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Rick.
Hi. 35-year-old guy, 6'3", range between 220, 250 pounds, and the last guy that you would look at on the street and say, well, there walks a bulimic, but have struggled, you know, with the binging and purging, and not always purging, just like was mentioned, you know, binging and then compensating it, you know, some other way, for years and years, and didn't address it until I addressed my alcoholism, and then realized that, you know, that the binge eating and that part of it became extreme, and that kind of took over, and it was all about control. I mean, it had really nothing to do with a weight issue. I mean, I didn't want to look like a model. I didn't have any delusion that I ever could, but that part of my life that I could control was the issue. And when I still haven't, other than just in my, you know, 12-step meetings, dealt with the specific issue, but I think that I need to at some point address it separately from my alcoholism. And what is the advice for that,
Dr. Bravender?
Sure. You know, from the study that we've been citing by Dr. Hudson and colleagues that was published recently regarding men and eating disorders, one of the findings in that study showed that of all the people they identified with bulimia, almost 95% had some comorbid psychiatric diagnosis. So that ranged from anxiety disorder and depression all the way up to alcoholism and other drug abuse disorders. So it's not surprising that bulimia goes hand in hand with other problems, particularly substance abuse. And I think that just brings up to the forefront how much of an addictive nature these disorders have. And with our patients whom we see who have multiple different diagnoses going on at the same time, it's almost like which are you going to treat first? And we know that they all feed off one another. And what we usually end up doing is taking a hierarchy of harm and addressing those issues which are causing the greatest physical harm initially, working on that and then working through the others. But sometimes it takes treatment for one issue, such as alcoholism, before you can even begin to address the others. Now, just like with treatment of an addiction, I think our Ron said earlier that you can't expect the eating disorder to get better if you don't replace it with something else to fill the need that the eating disorder is filling. And it's the same way with alcoholism. You can't just simply stop without finding some other healthier coping mechanism.
Rick, good luck with you. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have another point?
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that exactly the addictive nature, my addictive self, you know, as soon as I gave up alcohol, it said, well, you know, we don't need alcohol. We've got, you know, there's a multiple range of other things that we can, you know, stick in there and plague you with. But thank you very much. Enjoy the show. I'm really glad that somebody's talking about men in this issue. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Rick, and good luck to you. Here's an email we have from John in Cleveland. In the past 5 years, I've met 5 different men who had bulimia. All of them, including myself, are homosexual. My question for the doctor is this: did any results from the study indicate homosexuals are more likely to fall victim to this illness?
You know, that's actually been a common assumption in teaching is that gay men, we do know that gay men are at greater risk for a number of psychological issues. We know that gay men are more likely to suffer from depression and are significantly more likely to have attempted suicide than straight men. It's been long held that gay men are at greater risk for eating disorders, and there are lots of theories as to why that might be, whether it's increased emphasis on body or looks or appearance or a feeling of other kind of social alienation from the greater culture at large. The study in question here didn't really address that, and there have been small case series and smaller reports that confirm that, but no population-based studies yet. But I think from my clinical experience and from others' clinical experience, that probably is the case.
One thing the study did say was that as opposed to women who were in pursuit of thinness, men seem to be in pursuit of that perfect ripped body, and is that your experience as well?
Well, I think many, many men are. And there's a wonderful book that came out probably about 5 years ago now called The Adonis Complex, which examined this and looked at kind of young men's perception of the ideal body type. And one of the most distressing pieces of that was that if you ask teenage and kind of and men, college age men, to identify in these line drawings what they think the ideal male body type looks like, the vast majority of them will pick a body type that is unattainable without using steroids. So no matter how much weights they lift, how strict their diets, how much they work out, the body type they choose as ideal cannot be attained naturally.
Our guest is Dr. Terrell Bravender, who's an associate professor of pediatric psychiatry and family medicine director of adolescent medicine at Duke University Medical Center. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we'll talk now with Christine. Christine calling us from Rochester in New York.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, it's so great to talk to you. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Just wanted to comment or ask the question. I've been a high school English teacher for about 13 years now, and I watch these young men cycling through in sports. These kids are athletes, and they deprive themselves of food. They starve themselves for weeks on end in order to make weight, and then they go on eating binges. It seems so incredibly unhealthy, and I'm just sort of wondering, is this considered an eating disorder, or is it just considered normal training or rites of passage?
I consider it an eating disorder, and I think that it used to be back when I was a resident, it was taught that the only men who developed eating disorders were wrestlers, and that's not true. That other men do too, but I think that type of behavior is a horrible setup for altering kind of the normal satiety controls and the perception of what your normal body can be. And I know that probably about 10 years ago, there were a number of high-profile deaths on Division I college wrestling teams that made the NCAA take a better look at this and put in some stricter controls. But anybody who deals with high school or college athletes knows that it continues, particularly with wrestling teams. But any athlete who is participates in a sport that has weight cutoffs is always trying to get down to that lower weight classification for some perceived advantage.
And I guess the parallel stereotype was restricted to girls who were ballet dancers.
Right. And, girls who are ballet dancers or gymnasts or ice skaters are also at pretty significant risk. And the way we often think about that is that athletes who either are divided into weight classes are at risk, or those whose performance is judged subjectively. So the figure skater or the gymnast who's depending on that judge's score is more likely to suffer from an eating disorder than someone who has a non-negotiable outcome like a basketball or soccer player.
Christine, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Here's an email from Victoria in Tempe, Arizona. I have a nephew, age 29, who suffered with bulimia for 14 years. He's been to several rehabs for food disorders. Unfortunately, nothing has worked. He still believes his problem is due to other people. He won't take responsibility for his disease. His disease has almost bankrupted his parents. Do you know of anything we can do that will bring him to an understanding to fully recover?
This sounds like a very difficult and tragic situation. I think the way I would think about this really has to do with that addiction model. And at this age, once he's a young adult, I think thinking about it like an addiction is probably the best way for his family to help him. And the same way that an alcoholic may go in and out of different rehab programs, an alcoholic, as they teach in many 12-step programs, almost has to hit rock bottom first before coming to the acceptance of it and giving themselves over to appropriate levels of treatment. And I think that the family needs to be there for him. And again, working in a non-blaming, non-accusatory way, which can be very difficult. There's no doubt about that. But letting him know that the family is there and supportive of him and concerned and is willing to help him out. But when it comes to the changes, it's something he is going to have to do.
We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your questions about male eating disorders. Our guest again is Dr. Terrell Bravender, Associate Professor of Pediatric Psychiatry and Family Medicine Director of Adolescent Medicine at Duke University, 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. We're also going to be talking about a tiny taste of Europe ready to launch here in the United States, the smart car. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're talking with Dr. Terrell Bravender, a professor of pediatric psychiatry and family medicine at Duke University Medical Center, about eating disorders in men. If you'd like to join that conversation, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Matt. Matt with us from Modesto, California.
Hi, Dr. Bravender. I was calling because I had a question. I was wondering if you felt or have noticed if it's more socially acceptable for women to come out about their eating disorders than it is for men.
You know, I that's a great question, and I think it is, and particularly in teenagers. And I've seen a number of my patients who, as young women, who are almost proud of their eating disorder, and it's part of their identity and who they are. And all their friends know they have eating disorders, their teachers know, their parents know, and when they come into the clinic, it's something they're very proud of. I have never seen that in a teenage boy or a young man. It seems to be much more hidden, again, I think, because most of the press that eating disorders get are about women. I think that most of the treatment centers are focused on women's health, and it remains a fact still that eating disorders do affect mostly women, although many, many more men, I think, than we previously thought, are also suffering with eating disorders.
Does that perverse pride in an eating disorder, does that make it more difficult to treat?
Well, in a way it does, because just like part of the treatment of the eating disorder is trying to figure out what role the eating disorder is playing in that individual's life, and then trying to find something more productive to fill that role. And if an individual's identity is tied up in having an eating disorder, then replacing that, it can be done, but it's going to be a long road to go down.
Matt, thanks for the call. It's interesting, too, in treatment of eating disorders, in extreme cases that require hospitalization, it's simply the fact that a lot of, before people go into the hospital, family, friends, they can't be nearly tough enough with somebody who suffers from, for example, bulimia or anorexia.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the key components of our program at Duke involves bringing the family in and actually training particularly the parents in how to deal with their children with eating disorders. Virtually every treatment program in the nation uses a multidisciplinary approach that involves people from medicine, psychology, psychiatry, nutrition. We may have social workers involved, kind of body work professionals like massage therapists or physical therapists or yoga work and things like that. And we found that a key piece really involves bringing the family in, whether that means a spouse, grandparents or parents, somebody else, because certainly in the outpatient realm, we're only with these patients for an hour or, two, maybe three a week, whereas the family members are with these patients all the time. And they're really looking for help to figure out how to help their loved ones, and we're doing our best to teach them how to do that in a productive way.
And you've made the comparison with addiction. Is it typical for people with eating disorders to have relapses?
Well, it is. And we're always cautious when we have a patient come in and things get better, or if an individual has anorexia, and when that child gains weight, parents think, yay, great, we're done. Thank you very much for your help, and we won't ever come in to see you again. And that's not the case. And we tell most people that even the most successful cases whom we treat will have to be with us for about a year in the outpatient setting. And we're going to anticipate roadblocks along the way. And just like with other addictions, that should be anticipated. And we should help the parents and the patient, too, predict what those are going to be and figure out ways of addressing that before they happen.
One final call. Let's get Jennifer on the line. Jennifer, another call from Rochester, New York.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, there's an older family member, male family member in our family who seems to be somewhat of an unhealthy kind of preoccupation with maintaining a certain weight. I was wondering what would generally kind of classify eating disorders in men, and is it any different than that in women?
Well, the diagnostic classifications that we use are pretty much the same for men and women. And Ron earlier mentioned the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's kind of the diagnostic bible for psychiatry, and lists different behaviors and other parameters that you must have for certain eating disorders. So, for example, anorexia nervosa, you have to be below 85% of ideal body weight, as well as having a morbid fear of fat and some other psychological parameters. Bulimia, you have to have a certain number of binges with compensatory behaviors afterwards. And then binge eating disorder, I think Ron mentioned, you have to have binge eating defined in a specific way and some guilt associated with that takes place over a certain period of time.
Okay.
Those are all listed there, but here's the interesting thing is that those are really artificial constructs. Mm-hmm. And other data has shown that there's this kind of catch-all phrase for eating disorders that don't fit those like artificial categories called eating disorder not otherwise specified.
Mm-hmm.
People who come in for treatment who are worried about their eating or their families are worried about their eating, if we look at measures of psychological health and well-being in those folks with mm-hmm. eating disorder not otherwise specified, they're just as impaired as those with the diagnosable eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So those definitions we've got really are kind of blunt instruments for figuring out who has the disorder. And I think I would look at how much it's impairing his life.
Mm-hmm.
As well as his physical health is the most important pieces to look at.
All right. Well, thank you very much for answering the question. I love the show.
Thanks very much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
I appreciate your call. And Dr. Bravender, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
Terrell Bravender, Associate Professor of Pediatric Psychiatry and Family Medicine, Director of Adolescent Medicine at Duke University's Medical Center, with us today from a studio on the campus at Duke University. When we come back, smart car.